Hi, I'm Matthew Kind. Every Monday, look for a fresh new episode where I'll take you behind the scenes and interview the insiders that are shaping the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. Learn more at cannainsider.com. That's CANNAinsider.com. Now here's your program. Cannabis delivery platforms are evolving quickly, looking at ways to be more efficient and keeping a keen eye on retaining customers and reducing churn. Here to help us learn more about cannabis delivery is Chris Vaughn, CEO of MJ. Chris, welcome to Canna Insider.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of geography. Where are you in the world today?
I'm at my house in Los Angeles.
Okay, and I'm in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Chris, what is MJ on a high level? And can you spell MJ just so people get the right visual in their mind?
Sure. MJ is spelled phonetically. So E-M-J-A-Y, sort of a play on obviously M and J, marijuana. But MJ at its core is a shopping platform for customers to come and order cannabis and have it safely and reliably delivered to them. We also have today a retail store sort of in the heart of Los Angeles, but we have a handful of others coming online throughout the back half of this year and into early next year. So we'll have a sort of in-person as well as e-commerce experience for people who want to come in store and meet one of our team members, or if they want to order online and have it brought to them. But today we operate a store on Fairfax, sort of in the center of culture in LA, and then have delivery that covers most of greater Los Angeles.
Okay. And Chris, can you share a bit about your background and journey and how you got into the cannabis space and started MJ?
Yeah, it's, I'd say for about the past decade or so, I've predominantly been in the alcohol industry. So built a company from scratch called Saucy, along with two terrific co-founders, Andrew Lieb and Andrew Zeck and Daniel Lieb. And, we had been addressing this highly regulated category that really had been untouched by e-commerce or innovation or capital even in 80, 90 years. And have been on that journey for quite some time. And I think right when the recreational regulations started to come down or looked like they were starting to come down, I started to spend a lot more time focusing on just what did cannabis look like as an industry from a regulatory perspective? What did it look like from a customer perspective? What did it look like from a, I think just the history of the legal issues in the space? And was fascinated by really, I think, sort of two or three things. I started by sitting in on a couple of local community meetings in LA, just sort of sitting in the back and listening. And one of the things I'd say from a regulatory perspective that was very interesting is I heard, community members and neighborhoods really come to these things and oppose any sort of dispensaries being rolled out in their neighborhood. And that was a little bit of deja vu for me because we had heard so much about this in alcohol before. There's so many liquor stores throughout the country. There's more liquor stores than there are gas stations or grocery stores in the U.S. And, communities are actively trying to pull back sort of the number of liquor stores in a lot of these neighborhoods, particularly, I'd say lower economic neighborhoods that literally can have a liquor store on every single street corner. And hearing those meetings for years where people were sort of, we don't need this many liquor stores or cigarette stores on every single corner. And then all of a sudden here comes cannabis legalization. And obviously there's great consumer demand. People want it to happen legally. Communities want the tax revenue from it, but they didn't want stores to pop up on every single corner the way that they did in alcohol. And so that was very fascinating from a delivery perspective and coming from a delivery background to say, okay, there's demand. People want this to happen. They want this to happen legally, but they're very nervous about having shops pop up on every corner. I think the second regulatory thing that really intrigued me was that there wasn't going to be a three-tier system like there is in alcohol, where you can only be a brand / manufacturer or a distributor or a retailer. That cannabis in the US was going to operate a little bit more like alcohol does in some other countries like Brazil or China to a degree parts of Europe, where you could be the brand manufacturer and retailer all in one company, which just fundamentally changes, I think, your supply chain, fundamentally changes how you think about the customer experience. It changes your margin capture, everything else. And then around the same time, I was talking to some friends that had started investing in the space fairly early, and heard, you know, the story of one of my friend's grandmothers that, you know, had been going through cancer. It was actually a family down in Texas where cannabis wasn't legal. And the doctor honestly recommended just, hey, if you guys can get cannabis to her, like, you know, I didn't say it, but you should try. And it'll dramatically improve her quality of life. And they did. And it was a game changer for her treatment plan and how she went through that time as a person. And hearing similar stories like that, seeing some of the effects that, you know, obviously we have this huge issue in the country with opioid addiction, as well as, you know, PTSD and veterans, and started doing some of the research in those categories. And, you know, the combination of those things, I think the watching how communities were reacting to this, watching how the regulations were going to shape the way that companies could be formed, watching personal stories from friends and friends of friends that had, you know, it's a terrific medicinal effects from this plant. And then lastly, you know, the greater impact that it possibly has on sort of medicine or getting people away from reliance on opioids. The combination of those things was fascinating, and thought that, you know, our background and expertise could possibly create something pretty special in the space.
Okay, so you have this background in the alcohol industry, highly regulated industry. You're seeing what's happening on the community level. There's too many alcohol shops. You kind of feel like you have an aha or a moment where you feel like you understand this regulated market. It's similar to alcohol, but you're going to kind of go after it a different way than these traditional retailers who are throwing all this money into a retail footprint. Just talk about what you believe your unique angle is there.
Sure. I mean, so MJ was effectively formed in sort of a partnership with a couple different groups. There were some people in the industry. We had friends that were investors who had been investing heavily in the space, and a few sort of local operators, and all formed MJ. And, you know, myself and Daniel Lieb have effectively been advisors to the company since it was formed, and helping, you know, get them set up and running. And then in January of this year, we stepped into full-time management of running the company and growing it from there. So it's I think that the unique angle that we bring is, if you look at sort of the early days of this, the end of prohibition, if you will, and the green rush, and all these companies rising up and in many ways taking a very venture style approach to growth and building businesses, which is, you know, raise tons and tons and tons of capital, invest it all in high growth, burn lots of money in the process, but go after market share. That to me seemed very risky in an industry this regulated and with this limited access to capital markets. So, you know, you had a lot of companies come out of recreation, raise huge amounts of money, or go public in Canada, you know, via these reverse transactions or these RTOs. And you had a ton of retail investors pumping money into the space on these stocks. And it was just a race. You saw companies just racing to grab licenses, racing to grab leases on places, racing to grab assets anywhere that they could, because for a period of time, your valuation was almost propped up by just what licenses you owned. It didn't even matter if they were operational or not. And so that was really interesting to me, you know, and then seeing when Jeff Sessions came out with his letter, his memo, and all capital dried up for a period of a few months in the industry, that was very telling that, you know, this isn't the same as if you're building a SaaS company, or isn't the same as if you're building something in, you know, I don't know, the pet space. Capital can come and go very, very quickly in this industry. You saw it happen again with all the issues around vaporizers and Vapegate. And so you've had several series of events where capital can flood into the system and then flood out of the system specifically for this industry. And sort of that 1.0 wave of cannabis companies, I mean, there was a lot of carnage, and there still is a lot of carnage today of companies that, you know, in January of 19 were doing famously well, and then by midsummer, we're really, really struggling. and their stocks were down and everything else. And a lot of that comes back to just, I think, the underlying fundamentals of any given company. You know, if you think about people who are really pursuing this retail model, and you think about the economics of a dispensary versus a fashion store or a sunglass store or a pet store or even a liquor store, there's just a lot more cost that goes into operating one, both from a security perspective, utilities perspective. Most of the landlords back in this time, if you were a cannabis company, you know, they wouldn't issue you any sort of favorable lease. It was a lease with a hefty premium. The staffing of the locations, all of your costs on a per location basis could be much higher. And a lot of those, call it 1.0 companies, didn't care. And so you had people that were buying licenses at exorbitant prices, doing build outs on stores at exorbitant prices or going over budget, paying exorbitant lease rates, overstaffing stores, plus security, plus the utilities, plus the insurance. And then you turn around and the mountain that you've created for yourself that you have to climb up before you can even get to break even is almost totally insurmountable. And so I think that the interesting thing that we really looked at is, you know, there's a model in the space that was delivery only. There's obviously some leaders, particularly in LA and in California, on the retail side. The way that I sort of fundamentally look at the hybrid of those two things is that retail can serve as a jump off point for delivery, but because your cost structure at any given retail license is just much greater than it is in most industries, you have to maximize the coverage of any given location as much as humanly possible. And we do that via delivery. So the in-store experience is predominantly, we find, for some people that are kind of curious, if you will, some people that are, you know, veterans and experts that really want to come in and get educated on new products that maybe have come out or smell and see the flower that they're going to buy. And then we see a lot of new time customers trying delivery or the repeat purchases happening via delivery. And so from that one single jump off point, you know, on Fairfax today, we're able to cover a lot of greater Los Angeles, while in a retail only model, someone maybe has to do that with 4, 5, 6 shops. And that's 4, 5, 6 times the cost structures that are set up to cover the same amount of people.
So you're looking at this a little differently here. You kind of have a hub and spoke model where your retail store in Fairfax is kind of your hub, and you're thinking right out of the gate. It's not an afterthought like, oh, now I'm going to do delivery. You're thinking, how can I strategically have this retail presence and that be the hub for a delivery radius in the LA area? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, almost even the opposite, which is how do we cover a city with delivery and then make sure that we have retail experiences where if people want to come experience, a brand or a product or meet people or learn about the industry, they can come talk to people at one of our locations. That we're definitely sort of a delivery first company and then have that retail as well, because we just fundamentally cover so many more households, so many more customers via that delivery infrastructure. And I think that, you know, California was very thoughtful in how they approached delivery as a shopping part of this industry, meaning, one, you had a lot of communities and municipalities that were sort of arguing how they wanted to think about delivery. And so you had a ruling came out that said, if you have a delivery license, you can deliver anywhere in California. I think that was very important. And I think that a lot of people, you know, a lot of the communities view delivery as something scary because it reminds you of sort of a drug dealer, right? How did you get cannabis before it was legal? Guys driving around in cars selling weed, right? So in their mind, I think you think of delivery as, oh my God, there's weed going around in these cars. You know, it's dangerous. It's all these things. In reality, I believe that delivery is the solution that they're looking for when it comes to wanting the tax revenue from cannabis, but not wanting a dispensary on every single street corner in your city. There's huge customer demand. There is nowhere near the brick and mortar footprint built out to meet that demand. And unless you want to put it all in physical retail, the way to unlock that's via delivery. So I think that was one ruling that was very important. I think that the second is how they structured delivery, which is that a driver, as long as they have orders or scheduled orders or places that they can go out and hit throughout the day, they can carry up to $3,000 worth of product in the vehicle. It has to be locked in a separate compartment in the car. It has to be tethered to the car and secured. You know, you have to have trackers in the vehicle so you know exactly where the driver is at all point at all times. The driver can't just go off and, you know, go watch a movie or something mid-route. It has to be en route to an order. There's a lot of very thoughtful regulations around it, but that means that from a single jump-off point, a team or a group of drivers can effectively go out and in many ways act like little mobile dispensaries. So when we open up for the day, you know, while we are operating out of that sort of one initial place, we could have 50, 60, 70, 100 little mobile dispensaries all over the city. So we run both hub and spoke orders from a very broad selection. I believe that we have the greatest selection or the largest selection out of the delivery players in Los Angeles. So you can order hub and spoke of any of those products that you want, or for a smaller group of orders that are available in drivers' cars, you can have those delivered much, much faster as a sort of our version of Amazon Prime. We call it MJ Now. And I think in other states, they've really struggled with delivery regulations. You look at this in like Massachusetts, and it, you know, you can see how the regulations came out the way that they did, but it's, you know, you can't just have a single driver going out and doing an order. They have to be accompanied by a second person or security. Some of these states are talking about having body cameras. Every single order has to be hub and spoke, only one order at a time. And the way that they passed the delivery regulations was literally the exact opposite of everything that you could do to run an efficient and profitable delivery company. They put in place every single barrier that you shouldn't do to totally mess that up. But you get how it happened, right? It's people, community members, and regulators sitting around a table thinking about how do we do delivery? How do we make this safe for our communities? And people throwing out ideas. And then all those ideas come into something called a bill, and then it gets passed. And then people have to operate with that. But I think California did a very good job in how they think about, you know, unlocking delivery for the state, as well as the model so that you can actually operate it profitably or operate it in a way that makes sense for any given business to try it.
Massachusetts does. There's so many smart people in Massachusetts, but they have a unique flair for regulations that just confound. And I'm surprised they didn't regulate a helicopter that follows a delivery car with a spotlight on it.
Sure.
And it's like, it's really that it's gotten that far. But that's one of the reasons that Massachusetts license holders, that's a valuable asset because you're dealing with a nonsensical regulatory body that you have to put up with. I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, I'm hoping that there's some benefit for them. But let's circle back. You talked about the alcohol industry. What would you say your deepest insight from working in that highly regulated industry that you've taken over to now MJ, where you feel like, hey, my understanding of the alcohol industry is really helping me with this?
Man, that's a tough one. I have to split it into sort of two halves. I think one is definitely from a regulatory perspective, just working with regulators and thinking through regulations and how to do things, not only at with sort of utmost compliance, but trying to also do things from a perspective that benefits and moves the industry forward. You know, when we first started delivering alcohol, we didn't just go wing it. You know, we sat down, we met with regulators, we talked to them, we communicated our intention, you know, this is what we would like to do. And then we took it one step further, which is how can we also be helpful? How can we be beneficial, you know, help you with issues that you have, whether it's, you know, checking for underage drinking or all transactions being credit card transactions. So you eliminate some of this cash under the table business. And I think bringing that thoughtful approach to cannabis from the onset has helped structure in many ways the way that we operate as a business. And there's still a lot of fly-by-night delivery companies. There's still a lot of fly-by-night retail operators or people sort of operating on the skirts of what would be deemed helping the industry move forward. But taking that approach and being willing to sort of go through that brain damage and alcohol and then go over it again, you know, for better or worse, I think our team's developed a bit of a reputation for being willing to go through very tough things that other people aren't willing to go through or that are just confusing or brutal to navigate through. And we've been able to carry that over. I think on the other side, what's fascinating to me is the consumer. You know, in alcohol, I'll give you a small example. In alcohol, when we send an email to somebody about new products, it doesn't get a ton of pickup. Here's a brand new scotch that just came in, or there's this very unusual new rum that just came in. A very small percentage of our customer base cares about that. It's more so, I like Bulleit Bourbon, just bring me that, or I like this wine, bring me that. You know, new products just don't fascinate as many people. In cannabis, when we send an email about here's new products, and people just eat it up like crazy. They just buy it just to have it on their shelf at home. And I think that the difference is, like, if you went back to prohibition and alcohol and all you'd been drinking is moonshine or like bootlegged whiskey or something, and all of a sudden the local store said, we have a wine from California available, or we have a new rum from Jamaica available. You'd be like, oh my God, I got to go get it. I got to go get this one. I got to go get that one. I got to go get this stuff. But where the customer is sort of in their journey with the product is so different. And I think that that's fascinating. And I think if you rewind to the medical days where everything was just sort of in prescription bottles and, you know, or you were buying weed out of a Ziploc bag or something, and then you saw some of the first innovations that really hit, like the dosist pen, it was revolutionary. You know, when people saw the dosist pen come out and that you would use this or inhale this product and it would vibrate, tell you what a dose was, that was a game changer in cannabis. You saw other brands that were trying to mirror some of these like high fashion brands or whatever, and seeing just this gorgeous CPG packaging for the first time ever was a game changer to consumers. But even in the short period of time since rec legalization till now, you've seen that change dramatically, where people don't necessarily care if you just have some gorgeous packaging. You know, the number of vaporizers with all these, you know, interesting ways that you can use the product is plentiful on the shelves. And so if you're going to be a brand that stands out, you really need to know which customer you're going after and how you address that market. And if you think about, I'd say 60, 70% of our sales today are flower products, despite being in California, where we're probably more advanced than a lot of states in the different form factors that we're able to offer. But if you want to, you know, address the market today, you have to be able to sell really good, predominantly flower products to people that consume a lot of cannabis. If you brand yourself too much for that, quote unquote, everyone called it the Chardonnay mom, you know, in all these meetings way back when. If you brand too much for that, you're not going to address today's consumer. But if you brand too much for just the cannabis consumer of today, and you don't welcome the possible newcomer, then you're never going to get that customer either. So you're at this very sort of unusual, I think, stage in cannabis where what form factor will be the one that ultimately wins? What form factor will be how you introduce non-consumers into the category? What form factor will be the one that aficionados really continue to use, and so on and so forth? I think that that'll be fascinating. And a lot of our experience in how to think about consumption on a per category basis, beer, wine, spirits, mixers, et cetera, I think is transferred very well into how we think about that.
You know, alcohol is kind of a unplanned purchase. Maybe that's why there's so many places you can buy it. But where is cannabis on the planned versus unplanned purchase? And maybe talk a little bit about alcohol being unplanned and then where cannabis fits in.
I think they're very different. You know, alcohol is an impulse driven buy for sure. That was one of the early hypotheses we had when we started the company. It's proven to be true. You know, I think something like 80% of wine is consumed within hours of being purchased. So even early days when we were raising money, you had some of these venture guys be like, I don't get it. I have a wine cellar with 100 bottles of wine. Why would I use, you know, 30-minute alcohol delivery? And I was like, okay, well, you are less than a fraction of 1% of the customers out there. I think that to your point, there are so many retail locations where you can buy alcohol that if you are not fast, the person might as well just run out to the store. And so it usually is this, you know, I maybe even ordered, you know, Postmates for dinner. Or I maybe, you know, cook dinner, whatever it may be. I know that I'm going to have dinner tonight. I don't know if I'm going to feel like I having a drink later. And I, you know, maybe I have dinner, maybe I'm watching a movie or I'm getting some work done. And then you feel like having, you know, a beer, you feel like having a cocktail, and you can press a button and have it show up quickly. It has to show up fast. Otherwise, you're not going to get the repeat purchase. If it shows up closer to an hour, hour and a half, not bad. You know, the person's not complaining. We don't get customers that are like, that totally sucked. But it wasn't great. it wasn't a phenomenal experience where I'm going to transfer my buying behavior over to it. And so I think speed is very key in alcohol. Again, because if you're not fast, I could have just in that hour run out and gotten it myself. In cannabis, we are not seeing that to be the case. I think people buy cannabis much more like they buy groceries, where delivery is about saving you the trip to the store. It's about saving you, you know, the trip and the check-in or the shopping and all that stuff. And it's about convenience. And so, you know, we definitely have customers that feel like having a product. They want it right now. And that's why we have the MJ Now offering, which is it's brought to you, you know, in 30 to 40 minutes. But you can choose from anything that you want, our whole menu, and have it brought to you in closer to an hour, hour and a half. And I think that there was a huge emphasis by some of the delivery companies, predominantly Ease, in the early days of saying, you know, fast delivery, fast delivery, fast delivery. You had other people that were all scheduled, you know, scheduled next day. I don't think it's either. I don't think every customer needs it fast in this category. I also don't think that you can only operate in a schedule a day or two ahead model. You need to be able to provide both if you want to be a leader in this category. And we see customers, you know, utilizing both in different purchase occasions. But again, I think that there's a bit more planning. There's a bit more, I'm going to stock up on products that I like. I'm going to buy it a little bit more regular cadence. And we see that in the retention rates. We see that in the repeat purchase rates. We see that in which category people like to buy from, MJ Now versus the regular order. And so it definitely is a different type of buying behavior.
So you mentioned a little bit about this earlier, but a lot of cannabis retailers ran into trouble in cannabis 1.0, as you were saying, with the initial costs, the build out, the capital structure. There was kind of this firing gun, like a sprint, but you kind of took a step back, looked at it and say, well, really, these are the most important things to do to make a sustainable business. But how would you really say you're different in terms of how you went about looking at the metrics that you need to be profitable and sustainable in versus these cannabis 1.0 companies that kind of threw money at every problem?
Yeah. Well, you know, and some of this is, you know, the operator's fault. Some of this can be investors' faults as well, where you know, there's just tremendous pressure to go do whatever is seemingly driving growth. And to some of these companies, that was acquiring licenses. And so you had businesses that just used all their disposable cash on buying out licenses, getting them attached to leases, and then figuring it out later. And you know, when you sit there and you got a whole bunch of locations, you're paying super expensive lease rates on all these locations, you got license fees and renewal fees, and you don't have any of them built yet, or you don't have any parts of your business that are generating real income yet, you can get stuck. And in some ways, you know, that was the operators chasing those dreams, thinking that cash would be sort of unlimited and plentiful for a while. And in some cases, you know, that can come from the investor pressure of, you know, you need to get as big as possible. Here's the money, go deploy it as quickly as you can. I think that the key difference that we recognized was there's a big opportunity in cannabis where you can own your supply chain. And there's a big opportunity where, you know, we saw some of these delivery companies that just sort of provide a delivery portal to existing dispensaries and charge them a little fee per month. And they're going to go, you know, some of them have raised big money recently and they're going to go, you know, sign up every dispensary in the country. Well, guess what? There's not that many dispensaries in the country. Even if you sign up 2,000, 3,000 dispensaries, that's not a lot of people to be collecting fees from unless you're doing big, big revenue for each of them and can increase those fees or get them on annual contracts or multi-year contracts. Though you definitely will get some interesting data. I think on the other model where there was some delivery services just sort of trying to sit on top of somebody else's license, it put them at odds with all their partners because the margin was, you know, the brand is making a margin, the distributor's making a margin, that retail or delivery license holder was making a margin. And then if you were going to be a delivery service on top of that, you basically had to squeeze down everybody else's margin to create your own sort of fourth margin, and everyone got pissed at you. So there was this opportunity to come in, own our own licenses, own our own infrastructure, and be able to have a deeper margin capture. And because of that deeper margin capture, we have, I think, huge competitive advantages when it comes to customer acquisition. We have huge competitive advantages when it comes to the service that we're able to offer. you know, if I think about sort of the pillars of e-commerce, and you look at e-commerce companies that do extremely well, Amazon obviously being the best. One, they provide a trusted service, and they're bringing an offering that you really want. For Amazon, that's I can get basically anything that I want on this platform. And they really, I think Jeff Bezos had this great quote where he goes, Amazon doesn't make money when we make a sale. We make money when we help somebody make an informed purchase decision. And really what they did with products was help you buy, not just buy, but help you buy. And they create a lot of value there. Two, you have to have the trust that it's going to show up. And obviously through their infrastructure they built through the throughout the country, you know, the faster and faster shipping became a huge advantage for them. I think very much, very similarly in our space. One, we have more products available than anybody else. We are trying to help people make informed decisions on what products are the right ones for them. Two, we own our delivery infrastructure and our licenses, so we're able to control the experience. You know, I think less than 15% of drivers who apply to be on the platform end up making it to be one of our team members. This space is very different than Postmates and Uber and DoorDash and all this stuff, where all the drivers by law have to be W-2 employees, so we can really focus on training and the experience that they bring to customers. And then the last pillar that I think Amazon got really well that a lot of other e-commerce platforms don't is price. You know, when I buy from Amazon, I know that it's either the cheapest or at least a really good deal compared to other places that I may buy. A lot of other e-commerce platforms, you know, by the time I get to checkout with fees and so on and so forth, you are paying a premium because they are a marketplace sitting on top of other people's infrastructure. I think what's something that is incredibly powerful at MJ is because we own the licenses and the supply chain and the infrastructure. Our price delivered to you is the same, if not cheaper, than if you went to a dispensary. We price our products less than the predominant retail chain in LA. Our prices are less than the other predominant delivery service in LA. And that is the price delivered to you. So if you think about, you know, a competitive offering in delivery, whether it's grocery delivery, food delivery, all these other categories, you're almost always paying a premium for the use of that convenience. What we've unlocked at MJ, which is I think very similar to what Amazon has unlocked for the greater e-commerce market, is it's the same price as if you went to the store, but it's brought to you. And that is an extremely compelling offering for people.
Yeah, that is really compelling. I can see what you're doing there, and you really do have to capture that whole vertically integrated system. You got to have the license holder, the infrastructure, the delivery, and the W-2 employee, and then you can offer that. And then people start to think like more, maybe even more favorably. They think about the store favorably, but they're really start to get friendly and familiar with the delivery platform, which is, it sounds like, is what you want. And so just to mention again, you said that MJ Now is under an hour, and then for a limited menu, and then for the total menu, it's an hour and a half. Is that right? Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. The easiest way to think about it, sort of like Amazon Prime versus, you know, their regular offering, which is, you know, there's a select group of products that are available super fast if you want it, which is honestly just the top sellers in your area. Which changes over time, or you can choose from anything that you want, but it's going to come to you a little bit later, more like an hour and a half.
Okay. Do you think that, you know, in 5 or 10 years, we're going to see what you're doing just all over? Because, you know, maybe Binny's is probably the biggest alcohol retailer I can think of. There's probably a few others, but by and large, it's a lot of mom and pop businesses across the U.S. that sell alcohol. Is it going to be kind of these fiefdoms regionally doing what you're doing with MJ?
I think it'll fall somewhere in between. You know, again, if you think about just the costs that go into setting up a cannabis operation, it's not cheap, even just from a security perspective, but the way that the regulations are formed, even with some of the social equity programming and trying to give, you know, different members of the community, different opportunities in this space, it's expensive. It's heavily taxed. If you want to set up, whether it's a shop or a delivery operation, down to security and everything else, it's expensive. It is much less expensive to go open a convenience market or a 7-Eleven or a liquor store. And so because of that, I think that, you know, in many ways, liquor stores proliferated because of that. It was a higher margin product than groceries. It was a product that sort of is recession proof and always in demand. I remember when we first started working with liquor stores, we'd ask them, what type of marketing do? How do you retain customers? And you know, they looked at me like I was an alien. They're like, marketing? Like, I just show up at 6 a.m. and open my doors 7 days a week. You know, and it works. I think in cannabis, you know, because you have a very conscientious community now, and community being the community groups and neighborhoods and neighbor and homeowners associations and all sorts of stuff that all chip into these conversations, you're not going to have the proliferation of dispensaries like you had with liquor stores. You know, there's some people heavily trying to push that. There's some advertising platforms that obviously are trying to push, you know, unlimited cannabis licenses because that's more people they can collect revenue from. But I just think it doesn't make sense. You know, in today's day and age, when you have delivery and delivery can unlock this service and the tax revenue and everything else for entire geographies, you fundamentally need fewer of those retail locations. So dovetailing back into your question of what does that mean? A, yes, it's more expensive to set up a cannabis operation than it is alcohol. So I think there will be less players. Though honestly, some of the absolute best stores in Los Angeles are the independent mom and pop operators. They care about the product. They know it intimately. They care about their customers. And they're not the chains. They're not these, you know, public companies. And you can go to them. There's some shops in LA that are just absolutely fantastic. The staff is fantastic and they do a terrific job. I think on the delivery side, it'll be a little bit harder. Because honestly, delivery is just brutal. It is a brutal, tough business to run. Knowing and understanding all of the different KPIs and metrics and all the different data points that you have to track in order to make delivery efficient and profitable at scale is an insanely hard job. You know, we sort of joke internally that, you know, one of the reasons we started Saucy is because we wanted alcohol delivered to us. And in those early days, we were our own couriers. We did all the deliveries ourselves. And so, you know, it was a little backwards. We wanted to be able to order alcohol. And we ended up creating a platform where all we did all day long was deliver alcohol to everybody else but ourselves. But looking at delivery in any category, grocery, food, alcohol, cannabis, a lot of people, big grocers, whoever it is, step into the delivery game. They start to rack up some big numbers in terms of sales. And then they get bigger and bigger and then they turn around and they just can't believe how much money they're losing because it is very difficult to run and operate. We've even seen some of the big MSOs try delivery, pull back from delivery. It is different than retail. It is different than creating products. It is different than all these other things. It is a very tough game. And that's where I think even some of the marketplace plays that just sit on top of all these individual dispensaries that'll kind of do their own deliveries and so on and so forth. If you just want customers to have a reliable ordering system, you probably need to control more of that infrastructure yourself, similar to the way Amazon does. And you may have a bunch of delivery licenses that get issued, a bunch of small independent operators that attempt to do it. Some will make it, some won't, just due to the complexities of how hard it is to set up things like route optimization and batching of orders and scheduling and managing labor costs up and down. Not weeks in advance, but inside of, you know, half hour increments and all sorts of stuff like that. So I think it'll be a hybrid.
How do you think about, you know, the type of car or truck you have out making deliveries? Like, do you think, is it just internal combustion engine? Is it hybrid cars? Are you thinking electric cars? How do you think about that? And does it make a big difference on the type of vehicle you have as long as it's somewhat efficient?
Yeah, I mean, today, most all of the vehicles are couriers bringing their own cars, and then we retrofit them with both a tracker and a locked, you know, case that can go in the vehicle. Obviously, it has to be a specific type of vehicle. Like, it can't be an SUV that's just open access to the trunk. It can't be, you know, a Vespa scooter or something like that. And there's regulations around what type of vehicles can and cannot be used. We are evaluating and looking into buying some of our own fleets to have a hybrid. So, you know, people could either bring their own vehicle or drive one of our vehicles. Obviously, in a case where we have our own vehicles, we'll be looking at the most you know, economical or efficient approach, whether that's hybrid or electric cars. I think we also, just for the environment and everything else, do have a focus on how we have a small footprint as a company. You know, we're not going to be buying a bunch of, you know, diesel pickup trucks, as cool as that may be, to do deliveries all over town. That obviously wouldn't make sense. Yeah, I mean, it's something that we're looking into right now as we're looking at purchasing some of our own fleets.
And Chris, where are you in the capital raising process?
I'd say that MJ raised privately, you know, a round of capital when it first got started, primarily to start acquiring some of its early licenses. It's won some additional licenses through application processes. And, you know, it's backed by a terrific group of investors who, you know, honestly have deployed a lot of their own money, their own capital into the space for the past couple of years. We haven't disclosed how much money it's raised. I don't know if we intend to or if there's any real benefit to other than it gets you splashy press headlines. But, you know, I'd say the business is doing very well. We run lean operations that we know how to scale. And I would say that the company is in a position today where it does not need to raise capital, which is definitely a good position to be in as a delivery business. There's been a lot of investors and different groups, I think, reaching out, hitting, you know, my inbox and some of our partners' inboxes daily. People recognize, I think, sort of how quickly MJ is going, growing, how quickly it's sort of taking over LA in many ways as a meaningful option for people to be able to purchase. There's interest there. But I think for now, you know, we have enough on our plate where we're just really focused on executing right now.
Okay. Chris, I want to go to some personal development questions to help listeners get a better sense of who you are as a person. With that, is there a book that's had a big impact on your life or your way of thinking that you'd like to share?
Man, if I can, I'd say, again, I'd probably split it in two. I'd say one book that's had a major impact on at least how I view and see a lot of things, maybe somewhat cliche, but is Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. I read it early in high school. I read it again late in high school. I read it multiple times throughout college. I still read it once every few years today. I think as a fundamental way of thinking about humanity and how people approach problems, it's a very interesting book that, you know, many people have read. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. I think in many ways it predicts a lot of what we're seeing today in the world with people leaving cities and flocking out of, you know, crowded areas. I think that was very impactful in my both personal and professional development early on. I'd say more recently, a couple of books that I've read that I really enjoyed, that I've recommended to our team to read. And they sort of, I think are impactful to different parts of your life. One was What It Takes by Stephen Schwartzman, the founder and CEO of Blackstone. Incredible sort of life journey, from even his early years into how he got into college, to what he did after college, just always pushing through to the next level. Fascinating stories in there, and setting up obviously one of the most successful funds ever in history. But obviously how he approaches problems and thinks about the world. I think a fascinating book for anybody who you know, is starting from any point in your life, humble beginnings or privileged beginnings, but are thinking about where you want to go. Unbelievable story. Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, two former Navy SEALs. Incredible book just about leadership, taking ownership over, you know, not only successes, but really failures. Being willing to go through it when you need to. Unbelievable book for anybody in your company or your team, but particularly your managers and directors and VPs and people like that. Extreme Ownership, I think, really should instill a lot of characteristics as to how people should be thinking about their people, their team members, and how to uplift people. And then the last one that I thought was really good that I read earlier this year was Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. David Goggins, you know, extreme distance athlete, as well as former Navy SEAL, probably known as quote unquote the baddest man on the planet. But unbelievable life story of overcoming adversity, overcoming every challenge you could think of, you know, being like a 350-pound plus guy who I think was working at an exterminator company into being, you know, one of the preeminent Navy SEALs out there, completing multiple other military schools. And then today he does all the ultra marathons and bad water races, holds the world record for number of pull-ups in a day. But in terms of, I think, sharpening sort of your mental toughness, fascinating book for either your personal life or professional life.
Great. I hadn't heard of that one. Those are some great recommendations there. And it does seem like Atlas Shrugged's happening in real time here, especially when I see like Elon Musk saying, I'm leaving California. And then he's like setting up more operations in Nevada and Texas, kind of like, hey, you know, the people that are pulling the wagon, it's getting too heavy for all the people in the wagon. And they're just going to stop creating the things that they are creating for you and just leave if you treat them poorly. And it's happening not just in the U.S., but all over the world at once. And it's pretty interesting to see what's going to happen. I mean, there might be, you know, civilizations that move out to sea, like, you know, some venture capitalists are financing where they'll kind of be independent, sovereign countries out at sea that will say, I'm sick of all this regulation and tax, and we want to do our own thing and just be free. So it's an interesting time, and it seems like these trends are accelerating. Any thoughts around that?
I would encourage people to read the book. I think it's, again, an interesting commentary on human nature and how people think. And then obviously that permeates well out into society. And in many ways, I think has sort of predated a lot of things that are unfolding now. Yeah, the societies at sea and things like that, I think that that's a little idealistic. I've seen, you know, some of that stuff being backed. You know, who knows, maybe I'm the fool at the end that's not water laughing world. Anymore. Like maybe I'm not on, was it Kevin Costner? Maybe I'm not on his ship at the end of the day, but fascinating book, I think, on just a commentary on, again, societies and how people think and interact with one another. And you're definitely seeing, to your point, a very large exodus from California right now, a very large exodus from Manhattan and New York right now. You know, I was born and raised in Santa Monica, California. I love it here. Absolutely love, you know, Los Angeles as a city, the history, the culture, the people. It's tough for me to see some of the decisions that have been made in the state, taking, you know, the world's fifth largest economy into a place where, you know, we do not have the best schools, we do not have a lot of the best programs, and there's really no excuse as to why we shouldn't. It's very, very frustrating and sort of heartbreaking, but, you know, we'll see how the world continues to turn.
I think California is eventually going to come back and come back in a big way. It's just there has to be an acknowledgement of what's being done is not working. And there's a Stanford professor that says California's our the United States' first third world area. And he said that he has like 10 points. I think I can put this in the show notes. He has 10 points on what makes a third world country or kind of an economic disaster country. And the first one is no acknowledgement of what is being done is not working. And you can see at the top level leadership, there's no acknowledgement there. There's zero, you know, culpability. And until that changes, I don't think it'll turn around. But when that does change, I think that will be a harbinger of like, hey, things still look really bad, but the first step is there, kind of like the keystone, and you know, positive changes are going to come because California's pioneering spirit, the geography of where it is, the weather, how many people would like to return there if it was functioning better, is enormous. So there's huge demand. It's just not a supply of sensible leadership at the moment. So I'll be watching that closely.
Yeah, I totally agree. No, totally agree. I think it's you know, California is one of the leaders, obviously, in innovation and technology, and but it's also, you know, a leader in entertainment. It's a leader in manufacturing. It's a leader in agriculture in many ways. It's an incredible place with a lot of industries and businesses that could do tremendously well. Yeah, I think acknowledgement is a big issue, that certain things don't work. They just keep chugging along the same path. I think if you look at, if you have not visited San Francisco in the past 2 or 3 years, it's, in my opinion, a very solid example of somewhat of a failed state. You have unbelievable wealth. And if you just go out to dinner and, you know, talk to, whether you're in the VC communities or whatever, you see the problems that people are working on are fascinating. The companies that are being built are fascinating. And then you can go outside and you have unreal amounts of poverty that is not being addressed. And obviously some people like Mark Benioff and some of these others are all trying to personally address that or figure out how they can turn the city around in a big way. And huge props to, you know, some of the individuals taking that on. But it's brutal. It is a brutal example of what happens when you don't take the ownership in the first place. I think our leaders could probably do with reading the book Extreme Ownership.
Yeah, I was just going to say Taco, that. Yeah.
And Leif Babin. But I agree. There's definitely a world in which California could be a tremendous place again, and it's heartbreaking to see. I think, you know, I have three young kids, so even when you think about education and stuff like that, it's just tough. If you want to build a family and you're in California, and you just look at school rankings for basics, math, science, reading, I mean, we suck. And you think about wanting to raise, you know, children outside of just yourself as an adult, there's a whole list of additional questions that you have to be thinking about. So yeah. It's tough.
I think all the rules are being rewritten now is the good news. I mean, I think about where I grew up in Chicago. They spend about average $15,000 per pupil, but very little of that money actually goes to people's education. There's all kinds
of course,
infrastructure and bureaucracy and stuff. And I just think, hey, if a parent could, and well, you know, you're paying, a lot of parents are paying, you know, a ton of money in property taxes and they're getting just a terrible option. If you could just get on a card that said education card with a Visa logo on there or something, spend it where you want for your kid. I just feel like that choice would unlock just a myriad of options of what's available, but we're kind of caught in this cartel of education that's now really breaking apart. And I think it's going to be scary, but it's going to be great in the medium and long term.
Agreed.
Well, one final question here, Chris. It's a Peter Thiel question. What is one thought you have and that you believe to be true that very few people agree with you on?
Specific to the industry or about anything?
Yeah.
Oh man, I probably have a few controversial ones that I
would be. That's what there. We want. Give it to us. Don't sugarcoat it. We can handle it.
I would say that I think that most people sort of veer one of two ways throughout their life, and it can be impacted by the events that take place, their upbringing, you know, socioeconomic status, what they're told they can and can't do, all sorts of things. But I believe, you know, people end up either in some ways being, you know, the wolves, they're the strong, or they end up being the sheep and they don't believe in themselves. And I don't mean that in terms of predator and prey. I don't mean that in terms of violence. I don't mean that in terms of, you know, one attacking the other. But I mean that in terms of there are people, and it usually is through life circumstances. It's through you know, events that can take place. It's through your upbringing or your parenting or whatever. But there's usually some event or a series of events that can happen to somebody that either turns them into somebody who believes in themselves and they believe that they could make it through anything. And because of that, it permeates into all sorts of other elements of their life, their ability to take responsibility for things, their ability to take ownership over themselves or their body or their mind and try and push things forward. Or there's people that for one reason or another don't get that power and don't believe in themselves. And I think that permeates into all sorts of things where they don't take responsibility for themselves or don't take responsibility for the world around them or their bodies or their minds or anything else. And I think that you see those fall very clearly into sort of two buckets as to how people end up living their lives, you know, blaming others for things or taking ownership of things. Maybe it's not that controversial. Maybe a lot of people already know that. But I've also seen and witnessed firsthand people turn it around from being somewhat sheepish and not feeling empowered to do anything. And I think with a little bit of resistance training and direction, anybody can feel empowered to really become an impactful person who takes ownership. But again, sometimes it takes really hard life events to get there. It can take, you know, going through tough times at work or tough times personally or with family, and people respond to those tough times in different ways, but they usually fall into one of those buckets, and then it starts to permeate into other elements of their life. And I think you can identify it in people pretty quickly when you meet them.
Oh, that's great. Empowering too. Well, this is a good place to end, Chris. Where can people find out more about MJ? We've got a lot of listeners in Southern California, so let them know how they can connect, find your retail store, schedule delivery, and all that good stuff.
Sure. You can check us out at heyemjay.com, HEYEMJAY.com. Shop, browse, see our coverage areas, all sorts of things like that. You know, you can see us on social as well, on Twitter and some of the other channels. But yeah, probably best place for MJ is heyemjay.com.
Great. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show and educating us. You're a really smart guy, and I believe great things are coming for you. You're already there. So good luck with everything going on, and keep us updated as your story progresses.
Appreciate the very generous and kind words. We got a long ways to go, but thank you so much for having me on today. I really appreciate it, and looking forward to the next couple of years in this industry for sure. It's going to be wild.
If you enjoyed the show today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you might be using to listen to the show. Every 5-star review helps us to bring the best guest to you. Learn more at cannainsider.com/iTunes. What are the 5 disruptive trends that will impact the cannabis industry in the next 5 years? Find out with your free report at cannainsider.com/trends. Have a suggestion for an awesome guest on Canna Insider? Simply send us an email at feedback@cannainsider.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please do not take any information from Canna Insider or its guests as medical advice. Contact your licensed physician before taking cannabis or using it for medical treatments. Promotional consideration may be provided by select guests, advertisers, or companies featured in Canna Insider. Lastly, the host or guests on Canna Insider may or may not invest in the companies or entrepreneurs profiled on the show. Please consult your licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Final disclosure to see if you're still paying attention. This little whistle jingle you're listening to will get stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Thanks for listening, and look for another Canna Insider episode soon. Take care. Bye-bye.